the sound of praise for your Sunday morning.
The only one who could ever teach me.
Introducing Reverend A.R. Bernard of the Christian Cultural Center.
Was the son of a preacher man.
And Rabbi Joseph Potasnik of Religion on the Line.
The only one who could ever teach me.
Now, on Talk Radio 77 WABC, here's the Rev and the Rabbi, where faith matters.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
By the way, Reverend, I was just thinking that I see the bike lanes, you know, as you go down the street. I want to propose new legislation, and I didn't have a chance to tell our guest who we're going to have on later on, but I was talking to her earlier. We want bike lanes on sidewalks. So at least when you walk on the sidewalk, you know there's going to be a bike lane there, keeping you safe as you walk, because otherwise it's just turmoil. It's crazy. These bikes are all over, going through lights, going on sidewalks, going the opposite direction.
Yeah, and you raise the bike lanes, the bikes, you're also raising the scooters.
Yeah,
and the fact that so many crimes are being committed by scooters. They're talking about needing a license plate for an electric bicycle now.
Okay.
That's how regulation is trying to, you know, change the problems that we're having, deal with the problems.
Regulation is a key word today. So, Rev, I want to say thank you to you. You invited me and many others to a screening of a documentary. I think it was called Real Faith. And obviously you were the one who, you were the moderator. And I walked away, and as I said to you, I walked away uplifted because I saw a presentation that highlighted the importance of faith, the intersection of faith and culture, as you said, and the opportunities that we have and the necessity of bringing faith into that arena to confront so many of the difficulties of today. Well done.
Yeah. Thank you, Rabbi. And thank you for being there. You're very supportive. We try to support each other and all the things that we're doing. But we shot this pilot last year, and we're about to pitch it to some major networks. But it really takes a look at the issues that are taking place. You know, there is a complex interplay in our society of religion, morality, identity, and policies that, you know, we try to work through. And although we talk about the separation of church and state, you know, faith and American culture, American society, even government is so intertwined. You know, a lot of the issues that we are dealing with in our society that people are emotionally heated over have, even though they're moral issues, they have a religious underpinning. So to create a platform where we can have a program and discuss, you know, the faith side of it, the moral side of it, and see all of these issues through this lens, no matter what religion you are, I think is a powerful platform. Because you and I always talk about creating a space, a safe space for civil discourse. And we can differ, we can disagree, but we can have a reasonable conversation. And that's what it was about. So thank you for being there, you know, and your feedback.
What I found so heartening also is you talked about the different traditions, different faith groups, different beliefs. And at no point was the position taken that my belief is better than yours, that my religion is superior to yours. It was,
you know,
if this has meaning for you, then it's something that has to be respected. I can have something that has meaning for me that is different than yours, but there is room for both of us.
Yeah. I think that's what people are approaching broadcasting and content with. All right. They're looking and they're, okay, is this another attempt to, you know, convert me to proselytize, or is this a real fair discussion about the subject matter? We want to bring a fair discussion, you know, and not tell people where to land, but give them something to think about. We believe in our tradition that the desire for God, the transcendent, ultimate reality, is written on every human heart. We pursue it, and it results in all of these different religious beliefs, and it's codified into ritual and practice that is quite diverse, but it stems from the basic desire to know and understand meaning. What does it mean to live in this world? What does it mean to be human? What is ultimate reality? And we wrestle through those things and then apply it to all of the social issues that we're wrestling with as well.
And you don't have to compromise your religious identity to be liked or respected by someone else. The people that you interviewed were very proud. They mentioned Hashem, they mentioned Jesus, but no one said, no one gave a diluted interpretation of a tradition to satisfy someone else. And I think that is such an important statement, that you can be so committed to your tradition and not in any way be an adversary to someone who has a different tradition.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, Rabbi. And we have a guest that's coming
up. We do.
Before we do, I wanted to shoot something at you. Do we have a moment? What's on the clock?
About a minute. Rabbi? You can give me something to think about. All right, go ahead.
I will tell you, I read from this particular translation of the New Testament to my congregation on Sunday. And I told them I don't agree with it, but it's an attempt to be relevant. It's a New Testament for the Gen Z. It's an unofficial.
What was wrong with the old one?
I don't know. But let me give you an excerpt, right? And you'll probably recognize this. It's taken from the Gospel of Matthew. He was like, "Hey, teacher, which commandment is the most important in the whole law?" Mm. Jesus was like, "Yo, bro, listen up. The biggest deal is to love the Lord your God with everything you got, your heart, soul, and mind. This is right here. This is the top commandment, man, one that trumps them all." What do you think, Rabbi?
You know what?
What do you think?
Look, it's not something that I'd be comfortable with. However, we are not attracting all the Gen Z people that we want. If a different interpretation that still values the other tradition can bring people forward, can get them into the pews, then there's something to be said for that.
And this is a big debate, because my people responded by, "What about the sacredness, the holiness of Scripture?" And they're right. There should be, you know, something sacred about the text. And yet at the same time, we need to reach to these people. How do we do it? What are the boundaries? We're not going to answer that on this program.
Maybe once we get them in, we can get them to, you know, to look at it differently. But let's try to get them in. All right. Council member Ina Vanderkoff is our guest today. And she's a Republican on the city council. She's a very strong person in terms of her principles, and we are happy to have her. All right?
Yeah, so stay tuned. Don't touch that dial. We'll be right back. More of the Rev and the Rabbi.
This is Greg Kelly. To my friends in the construction business, if you've been injured on the job, make just one call to the Construction Accident Lawyers at the law offices of Darren T. Moore. With hundreds of five-star reviews, they fight for more justice for every client and have secured millions of dollars in compensation for New York construction workers. Call 888-444-ATTY. That's 888-444-2889 for a free consultation. More diligence, more persistence, and more justice. Prior results don't guarantee similar outcomes.
Where faith matters. The Rev and the Rabbi. Talk Radio 77 WABC.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joe Spetachnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
Reverend, I've come to know Council Member Ina Vanderkoff for some time, and I always say, fight for your principles, but retreat when you see her coming. She's a person with courage, with conviction, stands up for what she believes, takes heat for it. But, you know, Rev, you said to me some time ago, there's a phrase, be strong and courageous, in Hebrew, chazak v'amatz. And what it means is that you have to be a person of conviction, courageous, that you have to be able to fight for those convictions. You can't just have them. You got to be able to stand against those who challenge you. And she certainly embodies that spirit. So, Councilmember Vanderkoff, thanks so much for being on the program today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always great to talk to you, Rabbi, and nice to meet you, Reverend.
Thank you. Thank you again for being on the program. Rabbi, you want to get us started?
Yeah. So, Councilmember, recently there was legislation passed by the city council. I know you opposed it, about how many stops, and it was said this is going to now mandate that police do bookkeeping instead of spending more time, you know, patrolling, more time with the arrests. They're going to be doing, you know, all kinds of paper homework. Talk about it.
Sure. Sure. So the council passed a bill that would essentially require police officers to document almost every investigative interaction that they have. So we're not talking about a suspicious stop. We're talking about, you know, if they have a potential witness on the street, they approach the witness, they would basically now have to record the race, the gender, age of that witness. Now, they do this, as I'm sure everybody knows, so many times a day that it would just burden them and also create such an unsafe environment for New Yorkers, especially now when crime is such a big issue, right? Public safety is of major concern to New Yorkers. So we passed this bill. The council did, with opposition from the common sense people. And then the mayor vetoed the bill. And recently, the council overrode the veto, and now the bill passes. It's going to go into effect, unfortunately, in July of 2024.
Rev?
Yeah, I want to ask immediately because, you know, everyone had their arguments. The mayor's side and, of course, the NYPD side is that this is going to increase paperwork. It's going to slow down policing and take away from the time that can be spent actually, policing. And the city council, from what I understand, I had conversations with some council members, and they're concerned about the disproportionate number of persons of color, especially men of color, black and brown men, who are stopped and detained, you know, reminiscent of stop, question, and frisk. How do you respond to that?
I want to bring up something that took place. You probably heard about this incident. I don't know what you think about it, but I think it's important to talk about it. Right before this bill was put on the floor, Councilmember Salam, Yusuf Salam, who's a new council member, who seems to be a very nice gentleman. I spoke to him, when he got into the council. But something happened on a Friday night. He was driving in the city, I think in his district. He was pulled over by a police officer because a police officer saw a Georgia license plate and tinted windows. Tinted windows are not legal in New York City. So he got pulled over. The police officer approached the car. He pulled down the window. Councilmember Salam says, "Hi, I'm Councilmember Yusuf Salam." And the police officer says, "Oh, are you working right now?" He was on a call with other council members at the time. He was on speaker. And he says, "Yes." And the police officer says, "Okay, have a good night." The next day, council member makes a statement about this unfair police stop and obviously brings race into this. Now, the police officer couldn't have even seen the council member because the windows were tinted. So the fact that the police officer let him go immediately, which I don't think he should have, because I don't think that's fair to other New Yorkers to get pulled over and then get a ticket for a tinted window and for a Georgia license plate because he doesn't live in Georgia. He's been living in New York for a year. So there's even some potential issues with insurance fraud. But he was left alone. So instead of being grateful for the police officer being so respectful to him and leaving him alone, letting him go, not giving him a ticket, he makes this into a race issue, then cancels his NYPD ride-along, which he was supposed to do the next night before this vote. And I think this is such a big problem because everything right now is made into a race issue. And I understand that, of course, there are racists in this country, in the city, there are anti-Semites, there are all kinds of hateful people. But I think that for the most part, especially when it comes to policing, I think that most interactions, I don't think this is a fact, these are statistics, most interactions that take place with the police are fine. Of course, there are some racist cops, but overall, I don't believe the system is racist. And of course, we have issues that we have to address. But turning it into this, I think that this bill is basically our version of defund the police, which they did a couple of years ago, as you may recall. We defunded the police by a large number of money. And, you know, people went crazy because of that. Obviously, we believe that defunding and dismantling our police makes New Yorkers unsafe. And I think there are a lot of people, and Reverend, maybe you can talk more about this, but there are a lot of people that I've spoken to personally from minority communities that don't support this because they say we need more police. Our neighborhoods are the ones that are unsafe. For example, my district, where we have about three precincts, we're pretty safe here. Our staff are fine. We're okay. But it's the neighborhoods, it's the black and brown communities that need the police more. And to do this just further endangers public safety. We will also have to pay more for overtime because now cops have to do all this paperwork. When are they actually going to police the streets? So now we're going to have to pay more for overtime. And there's also an argument that it actually is not a positive thing for community policing because now cops are not going to want to talk to the public. They're going to be afraid.
Mm-hmm. I think it affects them in terms of the performance of their job, the value of stopping someone, considering all that's associated with it. But let me do say that the disproportionate number of stops of Black and Latino, Black and brown individuals, is not anecdotal. It's statistical. And it is true that within communities of color, there's a concern for both. Number one, security, safety, and we want police presence. There is no doubt about that. But at the same time, we're concerned about over-policing. And from what I understand, that, you know, this is supposedly to cut back on over-policing in any way. I don't know about that. You know, adding more paperwork and does dealing with over-policing mean that we put police officers in a situation where they don't want to do their regular jobs because of what's associated with it. So I question, you know, what's the balance here? How do we find some equilibrium in this debate?
But Rev, before a council member responds, we do find in so many communities, not just minority communities, people want to see the police. They don't feel safe in many areas. You know, I know walking around Manhattan, people tell me they look behind them. They're just afraid of walking down the street in the evening. So cutting back on that police presence, cutting back on, you know, the need to pursue criminals, the need to be on the streets more, that is something that is, you know, that's anti-community, if I could say. You know, we talk about anti-police. That's anti-community that wants to feel safe.
Yeah. Let me say, and you know, this is a public program. It'll be heard. I supported stop, question, and frisk, but not the way it was applied by the administration at the time. And I made that objection. But look, how many movies have we watched, Rabbi, and probably you, Councilwoman, where we heard the bad guy say, we better lay low because the heat's on. Yeah, we need the heat on so that we can begin to deter some of the attempts of crime or violence or disruptions or chaos or deviant behavior in our communities. It's just a matter of how these tactics are applied.
Yeah, yeah. Councilwoman, any further response to that? Because I want to go into some other topics.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like I said, I totally agree that we do need transparency, accountability. And look, I'm not saying that the police are perfect, but we had 2,500 cops turn in their badges last year. And the police morale is extremely low to the point where they literally just don't want to do their jobs. And I think that, and I agree with you, there's a lot of work to be done. I think we need more police training and, you know, a lot of work on transparency and accountability as well. But I just don't think this is helpful. I think this is pandering to that notion that our country and our police department is systemically racist. And I think just kills their morale. I think they will retire. They are already retiring quicker. And we are at the point where we're going to be left with cops that are not trained to do their jobs well, that are not even qualified, and that are just not going to want to do the work. So I think this is just not the way to do it.
Yeah.
Isn't it true that police
now is majority minority? I mean, there have been so many changes made in the hiring, recruitment practices that, you know, sometimes I think we fail to recognize the progress that has been made. And we only focus on, you know, the negative, but not enough on the positive.
100%.
Yeah. Let me ask you something.
I was going to say, I don't know if we're minority majority yet. I don't think we've hit that point yet, but definitely there's a larger representation of the minority community on the police force. We're talking 38,000 police officers. And let me say this, just to compliment, you know, some things that the councilwoman said early on. The majority of problems in the police department, because I was involved in some training with regard to interactions with our communities. And the majority of the problems are not these issues. The majority of the problem with police officers getting home safe at the end of the day and being able to take off the uniform at home. You know, these are the major issues that are taking place. It's unfortunate, like the subway, where we have a few incidents and forget that there are 3 million people using those subways. But what's highlighted are these incidents, these assaults that are taking place, and it generates fear. And how do you qualify, scientifically examine, you know, this feeling of fear that you and I've talked about, Rabbi?
Right. Let me go to something totally different. Councilman, has the City Council of New York passed any resolution condemning anti-Semitism, condemning what happened on October 7th, condemning Hamas?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because probably about, I would say, 6 months ago, I proposed a resolution basically creating a day to end Jew hatred, you know, a day to proclaim an end to Jew hatred. It was supposed to be April 29th, but it is now officially April 29th because that resolution passed. But can you believe that it passed with opposition from, I think it was 5 or 6 council members. Some of them abstained and some of them actually voted no. And you can look up the language of the resolution. It was taken straight from the ADL. So it wasn't some MAGA Republican talking points in the reso. It was not political. It was strictly, hey, can we have one day, just one day? I didn't ask for 2 days, you know, just one day, where we proclaim a day to end Jew hatred. And some of these council members said no. Especially, I was very disappointed with one council member who represents a large Jewish community. And she had voted no. After a lot of pushback the next day, she said she regretted her vote. She didn't read the resolution. A bunch of nonsense. So that was that. And then after October 7th, I tried to propose a resolution to condemn Hamas, but that never even came to the floor.
Why?
That was not something that
What's controversial about?
Well, so look, they don't give us an explanation. Okay. When we had put it in for the rezo, we were told that there were other council members that put in the same rezo. We were not allowed to know who they are. We kind of figured it out. Somebody was first in time. Great. I said, I'm happy to give it over to somebody else. It doesn't have to be me. But that resolution we had asked was not coming to the floor. I would assume, and this is obviously just like an educated guess, is that they were going to want to put in language that also condemns Israel. And without that, they wouldn't agree to put that to the floor. Mm-hmm. So we could not even bring to the floor a resolution condemning Hamas, just saying, hey, we don't like what this terrorist group is doing, murdering, raping, taking hostages. That's not okay. Can't do it. New York City.
Shouldn't be such a hard push.
Yeah. I want to ask a direct question to the councilwoman, because let me say that I appreciate the fact that you're willing to actually take on this responsibility, become a councilwoman, get involved in elections and go through all the process and take some of the stuff that you have to take by being on the council, because we need people there. So I applaud you So many people are running away from it or leaving it because they're just fed up. What drives you? Why do this?
So thank you for asking. I actually never intended on getting involved in politics. In fact, I was never even interested in politics. I always wanted to be an attorney. I went to law school. I opened my own practice. I had a practice for about 8 years. I loved it. I'm not one of those lawyers who like hates being a lawyer. I actually enjoyed it. I did divorce and immigration law. And then I just saw what I believe was a destruction of our city. I think it was 2020 during the riots, the anti-police movement, and of course, anti-Semitism. I'm an immigrant from Ukraine. I know we're going to talk about Ukraine. I am an immigrant from Ukraine. I was born to a Jewish family. My family, you know, not my immediate family, but I had great grandparents who were shot. I think, Rabbi, we were exchanging photos the other day of my great grandmother who was shot by the Nazis in Berdichev, a city that my family comes from. So when we were coming to America, we were really coming here with the hope of living a free life, you know, a life where we can practice and believe in whatever we want, practice Judaism, you know, be proud Jews. In where I come from, we weren't even able to go to the synagogue openly. I remember when I was a kid, I was very little, but I do remember this. We had a wedding, a family wedding in the attic with like six people because we were hiding. People went to jail for practicing Judaism. You couldn't openly go to a synagogue and worship. So coming to America, you know, it was the promise of a free place where we can, you know, like I said, pray and believe in whatever we want and just be free and practice whatever we want. And with the rise of anti-Semitism, I couldn't believe what was happening in this country. And, you know, now after October 7th, it's so much worse. And I think it's always been here. I don't think anti-Semitism ever really dies. I think it just goes to sleep. There are periods of time where it goes to sleep and then it arises again. And I think now the problem is also social media. People are encouraged when they see others being openly anti-Semitic. You saw what happened with Hamas. They recorded their crimes. They were proud of it, unlike the Nazis who hid it. And it's very disturbing to me. So someone who comes from the former Soviet Union, where we had to deal with all of that, it was very upsetting to me to see what was happening in America, and I wanted to stand up for my community.
So let me ask you, how is it you're a Republican in the city council, which puts you immediately on the minority side? You have people who refuse to pass resolutions that, you know, it's unconscionable not to pass them. One has to be devoid of a moral compass not to condemn October the 7th, not to condemn Hamas. How do you maintain, you know, your composure? How do you maintain that strength walking into a chamber where you know there are people who are hostile to your position? And are you able to communicate with them on any level?
Well, I maintain my composure because this is exactly why I did this. I didn't do it for a job. I didn't do it because I needed money. I did it because I wanted to stand up for what I think is right. And, you know, I keep winning elections and, you know, and doing it pretty well with pretty big numbers. So I think the people support what I'm doing. I'm standing up for them and I'm being a voice for people who really don't have a voice. And that's what I'm here to do. I feel obligated to do it. And I enjoy it. I don't think everything should be, you know, peachy. I have a lot of Democrat friends. Obviously, most of them are the sane ones. Sometimes I talk to the crazy progressive radicals, you know. I think here's the issue. This is obviously my perspective. I think that the radical left is not really the problem. I think the problem are the normal moderate Democrats who refuse to take a stand against the radical. And we kind of saw that with the police bill. We see it with other bills. They're just afraid to speak up. They're normal. They're people we get along with great. We actually have an outside relationship with these people. We talk to them. We know how they think. We know what they feel. And they're wonderful. They're centrist. But the problem is they won't speak up against the crazy. And Councilman, we need them. We need their voices. Yep.
Yeah. Do you feel that that's why you successfully flipped a seat that has been traditionally Democratic for more than 100 years in your district? Because
yeah,
there's
I mean,
this change, a shift? Yeah, please.
I think that, look, my district is conservative. There are a lot of Democrats who are just registered Democrats, but really they vote Republican. And obviously, before I ran, we looked at the map very, you know, in great detail. And we know how people vote. So I think they see a shift. This country, there's a lot of immigrants in my district. There's a lot of immigrants from the Soviet Union. And they feel the same way I feel about what's happening here. And, you know, I talked about when I was running, I talked about some national issues that really resonate with voters. Even, you know, more than some local issues, they care about those more than they care about the trash and the traffic, because there's so much more. There's so much more trouble in our city and country right now.
How do you address the migrant issue? Talking about family of immigrants, I have family of immigrants. So many do. How do you address the migrant issue today?
Yeah, well, I think it's actually have a great platform to talk about that issue because I'm an immigrant. We came here illegally. I also practiced immigration law where I represented immigrants who came here, some of them illegally. Right. So I think I have a great platform to talk about this because I am still against illegal immigration. I think that what's happening right now is a disaster. I think the border is a disaster. And I think our city has made a lot of mistakes in terms of the migrants. Again, I think we are a country of immigrants. We're a city of immigrants. We want more legal immigration. But we also can't do this at the expense of American citizens and New York City residents who are taking the brunt of what's happening right now. I don't know if you saw, was it 2 months ago about Floyd Bennett Field is a migrant shelter. It's not in my district, but it's in a neighboring district. And it houses about 2,000 illegal migrants, kids, families, and, you know, it's a tent. And we had a storm. It was pretty bad. And they had to be transferred somewhere. So they were brought into a high school in my district. So the kids had to stay home the following day because they had to come in. They slept in the gym. They slept there, which, by the way, was awful. I saw when I was there, I saw the kids coming in. They were little kids. They were very tired. They had to wake up at 4 a.m. It was just bad for everybody. It's not a sustainable solution, what's happening. And also, I think that the way that the city dealt with what's called the right to shelter law, I think they're really misinterpreting that consent decree. And they're really the way they're interpreting this is saying that everyone on the globe has a right to shelter in New York City. I mean, do you think that makes any sense?
Mm-hmm. I'm concerned because there's an article in the New York Post that talked about the debit card situation and the monies that are being given to migrants, money that for the most part is untraceable cash. Address that, if you would. How do you respond to this?
I mean, this is just on par with everything else that we've been doing, that our city has been doing. They've been basically handing out free stuff, housing, shelter, food, benefits, and now they're getting free money. I mean, why not? Look, everything they've been doing so far is actually funny because the mayor said we cannot take any more, but then we are doing everything possible to incentivize more immigration. So none of this actually makes any sense.
Yeah.
And also the national policy makes no sense because, you know, there is a failed national policy.
Yeah, yeah. Let me just say this concerning the mayor. Look, this is a federal issue, not a New York City issue. It has become a New York City issue, and New York City is front and center, how it's been handled, you know, there are problems with that. But this is a federal issue. How do you fix this? How do you respond to this?
So this is what I think. I think it stems from a federal issue. And then when it comes into New York, they are encouraging it more. So I think it's like a two-pronged problem, because we could really say we can't. If I could just talk a little bit about the right to shelter. The right to shelter, which is what they're basing everything on, the right to shelter is a consent decree that stems from the 1970s when a homeless man sued New York City and New York State for his right to shelter. And there was a settlement, there was a consent decree that was decided, which gave homeless people, homeless men at first, it was amended later to include women and children, but basically homeless people the right to shelter in New York City. That consent decree, it's not even a law, it's a consent decree, applies to homeless New Yorkers, not when I wrote a lot about this, and I wrote an op-ed about this. I actually went to court to support the mayor's administration when they wanted to change the amended consent decree. But the point is that this consent decree applies to homeless New Yorkers. It cannot possibly apply to the entire globe, because then we basically have to welcome anybody who crosses, who comes into New York City and says, hey, I need a shelter. I have the right to shelter here. That's ludicrous. Yeah. We can't do that. That's not sustainable. Yeah. But that's what we're doing.
Ed Koch used to talk about sustainability, that there comes a point where you just can't afford it. You may want to do it. You may want to open your doors as widely as possible, but you can't afford it. And ultimately, it's injurious to the welfare of the people living in the city who are here legally. So, you know, we have to be pragmatic. You know, it's nice to have all kinds of visions of what we'd like to be, but at the end of the day, you got to be pragmatic. And I think the pragmatism is lacking as we address this issue. We almost come
and
to
that's
the.
That's why we have a system in place. We have a system of law where you have to apply, you have to submit documents, you have to do this the legal way. Otherwise, what's our country without laws?
Russia.
And she's you raised Russia. You know, our councilwoman is Ukrainian-born American. How do you feel about what's going on in Ukraine, especially considering that we're seeing a developing Cold War in the Middle East, and, you know, Cold Wars are fought through proxy wars? How do you feel about what's happening, the continued problems in Ukraine?
I mean, just terrible. So like I mentioned, I'm from Ukraine. You know, I was first in the council to get up and make a statement supporting Ukraine. We passed a resolution that actually did pass unanimously, unlike the other resolutions about anti-Semitism. But that resolution passed. We expressed our support for the people of Ukraine. I obviously feel absolutely terrible. I think that Putin is a very weak and pathetic man, actually, because he just murdered his opposition, Navalny, and he keeps doing that. This is obviously not the first time. He's got people in jail currently that are probably not going to come out of jail just recently. I don't know if you saw, I think this was a couple of days ago, they arrested a dual citizen, a woman, a young woman from Los Angeles. She's an American citizen and a Russian citizen. She's accused of committing treason because she donated $50 to a charity supporting Ukraine. So she's going to be in jail for God knows how long. They just also, actually, I think this is very recent. They just, they say he committed suicide. Andrei Morozov, who's a military blogger, and basically said that there are a lot of casualties, that Russia has just sustained a lot of casualties. All of a sudden, he's committed suicide. That's why I think Putin is a very weak man, and he can't even.
You know, we know. I think sometimes we tend to romanticize situations. We think if only we'd sit down and talk to Hamas, if only we would sit down and talk to Putin, that we could sway them, you know, to be more centrist, more normal, you know, less destructive. I think it's a very naive approach. I think Putin is evil. Hamas is evil. And you can't live peacefully with people who seek to destroy you.
No, there's no peaceful approach with these terrorists. Putin's a terrorist. Hamas is a terrorist. They only understand strength. I don't think that you could sit down with them. These are people who want to kill you.
Yeah.
I think also, you know, Americans for the most part don't understand that, you know, the Palestinians, Hamas, you know, that land is not monolithic in terms of its political opinions. Mm-hmm. They're not all on the same page. And essentially, you people who are at war with themselves can't give you peace. Mm-hmm. So there can't be peace that comes out of a situation where there's turmoil within that space itself, apart from Israel, apart from the issue with Israel.
And we learn one thing: when someone says he wants to destroy you, whether it's Putin, whether it's Hamas, believe them. They want to destroy you. We've come to the end of the segment. Reverend Ina Bernikoff has said to me many times, I look forward to one day you officiating at my wedding. Am I right, Ina?
Absolutely.
All right. There's only one problem. We're missing one person in that equation. That's the only thing, Ina. So we're waiting.
You see, I wouldn't have brought that up on national radio. See, this is what I apologize for in the beginning of the broadcast.
Hey, this is great. We've got to get creative here.
Ina Bernikoff, you're a very strong person. And the strength comes from your belief. And the strength comes from your personal history. Everything that you're family endured and others endured, my family endured, inspires us to stand strong so they can't get away with it again. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right.
God bless. And stay tuned for more of the Rev and the Rabbi right here on 77 WABC. We'll be right back.
Reverend A.R. Bernard, Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, where faith matters. The Rev and the Rabbi, Talk Radio 77 WABC, and the all-new WABCRadio.com.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
You know, Reverend, I admire leaders who have the courage to take a stand publicly, not to compromise what they feel is essential, is something that's part of their discipline. And Ina's that way. She's not looking to be popular. She's just looking to be principled, to look in the mirror and say, I did what I thought was right.
I appreciate that she has a certain perspective that she brings to the council on these issues and willing to stand for, you know, how she sees it. I think that's very, very important, especially when you're a minority.
Yeah.
And she has experience being a minority. And to bring that to the council, ideological differences, and fight for what she believes, I respect that. Again, Rabbi, we have too many people not getting involved because of how tough it is, how chaotic it is, and, you know, how the moral boundaries and ethical boundaries that we used to apply ourselves to in politics, it's no longer there.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a problem.
You know, she said something about people who are centrist afraid to speak out. Mm-hmm. So you think to yourself, well, if you don't speak out, then you really don't stand strongly for a position and you allow your adversaries to defeat you. Because they certainly have no trouble being vociferous. And if you're silent, they win the day. And I think that's true in so many cases. Look, I see members of my community who are weak. You know, they're afraid somehow to ruffle feathers or afraid to upset a relationship. So October the 7th, and you and I have spoken about this, was a defining moment for us. Because we saw who stood with us, but we also saw who didn't stand with us.
Yeah.
Right? And I think you have to be able to stand and say to those people, we know exactly where you are.
Yeah.
And we condemn where you are. And they have to know that because you just can't continue to have this superficial relationship if it's not predicated on substance, if it's not predicated on principle.
Yeah. And look, the loss of life on any side is a problem. We believe we stand for the transcendent value of worth, dignity, and value of every individual, every human person. And for me, that takes precedence. You and I have met with families whose children are being held hostage or who lost a parent, you know, who are grieving. Mm-hmm. And but you know, you can want peace, but that's a two-way street. It can't be one-sided. And you've got to be willing to make the commitments necessary for peace. Yeah, it's a tough thing, Rabbi.
Yeah. Yeah. But you're right. I mean, if you to me, reasonable people want peace. Nobody wants to see their families, their loved ones killed. But I think there are some who take a different point of view. Their hatred for the other overrules their desire to live in peace. They're so consumed with hatred for the other, they're even ready to sacrifice their loved ones in the name of that hatred. So you see young kids being taught, hate the Jews, hate the Israelis. It's very hard to live with those, you know, and say, well, if only we would simply sit down and talk. But we've had those opportunities. We've made proposals, but we're still in a place where people say, we are going to wipe you off the map.
There can only be peace at a table where those who sit at the table are people of goodwill.
Mm-hmm.
If you have ill will, there's not going to be peace.
Yeah, yeah.
Not going to happen, because peace requires negotiation. It requires compromise. It requires trade-offs. And if you're not willing to engage in that because you have one and only one agenda, there's not going to be peace.
Yeah.
No. It's unfortunate. And we're, you know, look, we're prisoners of hope, you know, you and I, that's mm-hmm. what we are as clergy. And yet we have to be honest when we see a situation that can be hopeless because individuals don't want to cooperate.
You know, Dara Horn is a great author. She's written a number of articles, and recently she wrote something for The Atlantic. And she says, you know, Jewish students on campuses are not looking to stifle free speech. They just don't want to be attacked when they walk on campus. They don't want to have to hide in a library. They don't want to have to conceal the Jewish star or the mezuzah on the door. They want to be able to live as Jews. We can disagree with all of that. We also agree that you have no right to destroy me or to seek to destroy me.
Yeah, yeah. And you have a right to defend yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
That's real. You know, look, turn the other cheek, Jesus said, but I only got two cheeks.
Yeah.
What happens after that?
Yeah, yeah. Right. Yeah. Do I hear you leaning towards the Jewish position here?
Wait a minute.
I kind of hear a little change of direction. Yeah. No, but you're right. You're right. Listen, look back to World War II. Look back to, you know, the Nazi determination to destroy the Jews and to others, those who hid Jews, those who they deemed to be different. What do? A ceasefire and put people back in the same position they were in before they started to destroy you? I mean, I mean, there's got to be a real decision made that we can't live with these people because they don't want to live with us. They really, at the end of the day, they don't want us to live, and they certainly don't want to live with us. So it's a very painful thing to watch, but sometimes there's no alternative. As you say, you have to defend yourself.
Great interview, though. It's good having the councilwoman on and hearing what she has to say about these issues. And again, I'm impressed with her commitment to a hostile environment and politics. It doesn't matter what side you're on. It's a hostile environment.
And you got to be able to take the heat. I mean, comes with the territory. When you stand up for what you think is right, you're going to be attacked. We know that. She knows that. But that's the price you pay for having a spine.
And it goes back to what you said about courage, you know, our conversation about courage. And that's the willingness to have the totality of your being mm-hmm. aligned towards a particular goal or value that you stand for. And that takes courage.
And being willing to confront those who challenge you.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
All right, Rev. Good conversation. Yep. Yep. Look forward to more.
Yeah. We'll be back next time right here on 77 WABC. You know the program,
The Rev and the Rabbi.
And the Rabbi.